This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here, we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can listen to us live, or you can listen to past shows on our iPod Ready archives. If you have Nokia phones, you can also listen to us via satellite. So just go to the website for details. We're really excited tonight. I especially am excited tonight because I specifically requested this guest. Stanton Friedman is one of the most well-known and renowned and respected investigators of UFOs in the world today. He has spoken before Congress. He has spoken at the UN. And, I mean, he's even debated and won debates at Oxford in this area. Hello, Stan. It's a great pleasure having you with us tonight.
My pleasure to be on. The more the merrier.
The more the merrier. Do you know how many times I've gotten beam me up, Basma?
No.
A lot.
I don't know how many. A lot.
A lot. Stan, your new book, Flying Saucers in Science, it shows that the existence of UFOs of the alien kind, and you do understand that, and this is something that you're very strong in expressing, is that not all UFOs are of the alien kind.
Right, right. Most are not, just like most isotopes aren't fissionable. And most people aren't 7 feet tall, and the coach says, I don't care about the midgets, give me the big guy. It's the same with flying saucers. That's why the book is Flying Saucers in Science rather than UFOs in Science, because all flying saucers are UFOs, but not all UFOs are flying saucers. Much as, let's say, all great-grandfathers are men. I happen to be one, and not all men are great-grandfathers. So if you're interested in study flying saucers, that's one thing. If you're just interested in dumb old UFOs, that's something else. You got to sort and sift and stick with the good stuff. Forget the junk.
So basically what you're doing in this book is debunking the debunkers.
Right. Yeah, I've even given lectures with that title. And what I've found over the years, this is sort of my magnum opus, my fourth book, and, you know, I've given over 700 lectures, and in an hour, hour and a half, you can hardly cover the whole subject, and a book gives you much more opportunity to go into detail, to provide ammunition, if you will, for those who are seeking truth, but need a little help with getting the facts in hand before putting them out their computer in gear. And so, you know, there's a whole chapter on the five large-scale scientific studies that I talk about in my lecture, you know, in 5 minutes. There's a whole chapter on you can get here from there, which I cover in probably 3 minutes in my lecture. And there's a whole chapter on the UFO why questions, WHY, which I only cover in the question and answer period, really, in my lecture. So here's a chance to deal with facts and data and solid information. And, for example, there's a whole chapter on the cult of SETI, S-E-T-I, which most people think, unfortunately, stands for a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I think it stands for silly effort to investigate, S-E-T-I. And I go into detail as to why that's the case. And it will make the SETI cultists angry, but sometimes you have to stir the pot a little bit and not put up with the garbage that you get from the noisy negativists. And sometimes it's nasty, noisy negativists, too. You know, there are four basic rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation because investigation is too much trouble and nobody will know the difference anyway. Now, you realize you can use these rules to debunk anything, any kind of so-called paranormal phenomena or any viewpoints you don't like, you know. It's the easy way. But as a nuclear physicist, I believe you got to go to the facts, the data, the solid information, and not stick with the junk, the repeated garbage that you get from the noisy negativists.
Well, you talk about them. You call them noisy negativists, but aren't they really clueless deniers?
Oh, that's it. I like that, cluelessly deniers. Yeah, sure, ancient academics, fossilized physicists, whatever you want. Clueless deniers, yeah. Arrogant clueless deniers. That's the
absolutely
thing that gets me. You know, the people who do their research by proclamation make it sound like, well, they've studied the evidence, and like the SETI people. There is no convincing UFO evidence, but you look high and low and you never find any references to the large-scale scientific studies that I talk about. You know, I read their books. They sure don't read mine. I've sent a copy to Seth Shostak.
I can't imagine that that's true. I have a feeling they're keeping tabs on what you're talking about, Mr. Friedman.
Well, it may
really
be.
They'd have to be crazy not to.
Well, it's easier if you don't know what's going on to say that there's nothing going on. When I spoke, Seth Shostak and I each gave 3 lectures on the last westward voyage of the Queen Elizabeth II back 3-4 years ago. And we attended each other's lectures. We were cordial to each other. I asked in the course of my lecture, my first lecture, I talked about these 5 large-scale scientific studies, and I asked after each one how many people here have read this. And Seth didn't raise his hand at all. Now, we did a debate on Coast to Coast Radio 6 months later for 3 hours. And he still hadn't read any of them. And, of course, I'd read 2 of his books before I went on the trip. The same thing happened to Larry King in the first show that I did in the last 15 months. I've done 3 with him. The first one in July of 2007 had, too many people, a total of 8, I think, not all at the same time. But sitting next to me was Dr. Michael Shermer playing with alien dolls. That was his contribution to the science of ufology. And so I challenged, George Noory was also on that show, so I contacted George, and Michael had been on George's show before, so I said, how about having Michael and me on together for a debate? So 2 weeks later or so, we debated for 3 hours. I mean, that's 3 to 6 in the morning, my time, you understand. It was only, it was 4 hours earlier for Michael. Anyway, I got 80% of the vote. Why? Because he hadn't read any of the sources and started out with a totally false claim expressed casually. There's only, you know, there's nothing special about UFOs. Every strange phenomenon, there's 5% that, you know, a residue phenomena, if you will. And I had a say, no, totally untrue, the largest study ever done, it was 21.5%, that's Blue Book Special Report 14, completely separate from the 9.3% that were listed as insufficient information, and I went on to 4 or 5 other studies, and which he obviously wasn't aware of, and then I even quoted from his book, because I'd read 2 of his books, he hadn't read any of mine, and so it's no wonder I got 80% of the vote. And I doubt if he would take me on again because it would mean he'd have to do some homework, and these guys don't want to do any homework. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. And, you know, he's head of the Skeptic magazine and the Skeptic Society, and they have lots of ads for skeptical materials, and we don't want to intrude on that with facts. And so,
Let me ask you something.
Sure.
You know, your claim is that secrets can be kept somehow.
Yes.
However, are they really keeping secrets? Because, in fact, it's almost blatantly in our faces that there is something going on, whether it is extraterrestrial intervention or not. But is this more of a case of just muddying the waters of what's real and misleading people into questioning themselves?
Well, No, there's more to it than that.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Now, I've been to 20 archives, and I wrote, I had a security clearance for 14 years. I wrote classified documents and so forth. Yes, it's generally accepted around in the world. I have a whole chapter in the book about public opinion polls, and contrary to the notion of the noisy negativist, most people do believe in flying saucers, and the greater the education, the more likely to, but they're afraid to admit it publicly because of fear of ridicule. But the kicker here is that there's a great deal of material that is definitely kept secret about UFOs. I mean, if you look, the National Security Agency, 15 years after they admitted they had 160 classified top-secret code word UFO documents, which they couldn't release any of because of sources and methods information, after 15 years, they finally released all 160 pages. The only trouble is you can only read about one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out. They stopped blacking out things because they weren't happy with my showing blacked-out NSA documents on television. They speak wonders, you know, and 80% of the page is blacked out. But the kicker here is we have the statement from Air Force General Carol Bolander in 1969. He was working on the lunar excursion module at which we landed successfully. You know, we landed on the moon successfully in 1969, July. And earlier that year, the University of Colorado study, the so-called Condon Report, had recommended that Project Blue Book be closed. As far as we all knew, that was the only government effort concerned with UFOs. Well, he was asked, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Now, he was a brigadier general. He had no previous connection with UFOs. So it was, you know, an unbiased opinion. Okay, he puts out a memo in October of 1969, which resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book. He was certainly right that it wasn't contributing anything to science or intelligence, as a matter of fact. And I visited Project Blue Book a number of times at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, so that's not just an observation from the distance. Anyway, in the course of this memo, he says, quote, "Moreover, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army-Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system." That's an incredible statement. And two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the regulations established for that purpose. A truly remarkable claim. And so I managed, this is a number of years ago, I managed to locate General Bolander, and he knew exactly what he was saying. The good stuff didn't go to Blue Book. I mean, suppose a saucer flies down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored. That's a national security problem. That's very different if you and I are standing at the end of my driveway looking as a flying saucer goes over. Oh, well, happens all the time, no big deal. But violating our airspace, forbidden to fly over the SAC Strategic Air Command bases. So, yes, there really is stuff. And remember, there's another part of this. All the good systems for monitoring the skies, the best systems are the radar systems established by the Air Defense Command, the space systems set up by the National Reconnaissance Office with the big, expensive satellites which can tell when the Russians have launched an intercontinental ballistic missile, you know, in 2 minutes or less than that, I guess. All these systems provide data that's classified. You don't get weekly reports of how many times we scrambled jets after UFOs. Now, there was one case where they did. In 1952, after orders had been issued to military pilots to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, I don't know how our pilots were supposed to instruct the aliens to land. You know, point down, down boy, down, or something. Anyway, these were orders. As a matter of fact, the head of the American Rocket Society wrote President Truman saying he didn't think that was a good idea. But anyway, a general stated that we had scrambled jets, this is that summer, over 300 times. Now, one of the things that's certainly being kept secret is I have had 7 different independent reports of UFOs being zapped, I mean, of our planes being zapped by UFOs. And if I've heard 7
really?
Of these, there's got to be a lot more. Yes. And in addition, you know, the number of planes that crashed, Frank Fascino has a new, relatively new book out called Shoot Them Down. Great name for it. That's F-E-S-C-H-I-N-O, Jr., Frank Fascino, Jr. It's listed on my mm-hmm. website at www.stantonfriedman.com. Anyway, Frank went through, at my suggestion, went through the New York Times, 1951 and 1956, found 200 cases of fatal interceptor crashes. It's not just accidents, in other words. These are accidents where the pilot was killed.
And well, when you say interceptor...
Well, fighter planes, whose job it is to protect the United States against intruders, to intercept all intruders. You know, the Russians are coming kind of thing. And, you know, 5 of those pilots, there's over 200 cases now, 5 of those pilots had over 100 missions in Korea. Now, they were being chased by MiGs over there. You've got to be a pretty darn good pilot to survive over 100 missions in Korea, don't you think? I mean, when you got enemies trying to shoot you down, you know, it's not just the weather you worry about, in other words. And yet, they come back to the United States where there are, last I heard, no MiGs, and they die in fatal accidents. That seems a bit extreme. And the New York Times used 2 interesting words on occasion. They said disintegrated and or disappeared. What kind of words are those to use for an airplane accident? You know? I mean, these are military planes. These aren't. Yeah, well, these are military planes. These are not Piper Cubs by some amateur pilot. And so they're expensive for one thing, and highly trained pilots are expensive too. So we're not talking a trivial problem here. And trying to get accident reports. Boy, I've been to 20 archives, and accident reports, a lot of them are classified, well, because we don't want the families to sue whoever built the airplanes, you know. Well, that's one excuse, I suppose. We want the people who talk to us to be open and above board, but it's very hard to get your mitts on these reports, is what I'm saying.
It would
even
certainly seem so. We have with us Stanton Friedman tonight, famous, world-renowned UFO researcher. Mr. Friedman, or Stan, why?
Stan.
Why?
What?
Why are they keeping it a secret?
Well, there's an article on my website called The UFO Why Questions, and I have a whole chapter in Flying Saucers and Science. But in short form... First, you want to figure out how they work. That's what's important about a flying saucer. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems. And the United States has spent, I mean, literally billions of dollars developing better military aircraft. You know, the SR-71, the U-2, the F-17 stealth plane, the B-2, the B-1. These things cost oodles of money to develop. So we're obviously interested in doing that. So you want to figure out how they work. After all, we got wreckage from Roswell. You set up your secret project. And rule number one for security, you cannot tell your friends without telling your enemies. Because your spies from the other guys, and there are spies around, listen to the radio. They read what's on the Internet. They read newspapers and television. So you cannot tell your friends without telling your enemies. So that's the first problem. The second problem is the other side of the same coin. What if the other guy figures out how they work before you do? There have been crashes elsewhere. I'm thinking of Russia and Brazil in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to know. You know. They know. Weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon. You know, we've been playing this game for years. The third problem is quite different. It's a political problem. Suppose you were to make an announcement tomorrow by highly trusted individuals around the planet. Now, it's pretty hard to find any people, but I like my favorite couple is the Queen and the Pope. They're about the same age, a nice couple. what if they say, indeed, some UFOs are alien spacecraft, and they're neutral, and, you know, we're going to have conferences about the political, religious, economic implications of that. Well, what would happen? Well, I think church attendance would go up, mental hospital admissions would go up, the stock market would go down if it could still go down farther than it has very recently.
True.
you know, and but I think one of the biggest things that would happen, based on my more than 600 college lectures, so I have a lot of exposure to students, and that is that the younger generation, which unlike me was never alive when there wasn't a space program, would immediately push for a new view of ourselves instead of as Americans, Canadians, Greeks, Peruvians, Chinese, Korean, whatever, as Earthlings. And some people say, well, gee, that'd be great, Stan, don't you think? I say, well, sure it would, but do you know of any government that wants its citizens to owe their primary allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government? Far as I can tell, nationalism is the only game in town. Now, there's a fourth problem. In other words, people in power don't want to give up power. You ever know anybody who had power and wanted to give it up? It's
not
pretty rare.
Not a one. Not a one.
The fourth problem is, well, it's kind of weird. Religious fundamentalists, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell come to mind, the late Jerry Falwell, have loudly proclaimed publicly that we are the only intelligent life in the universe. This UFO stuff is the work of the devil. Now, what an insult to the notion of an all-powerful God. This is the best she can do? You know, we're a primitive society. Our major activity is tribal warfare. And they'd be up the creek without a religious panel. You remember how important they were in elections just a few years ago. There's a fifth problem. Some people have said, Stan, look, if these guys are coming here and we're not going there, obviously they're more advanced technologically than we are. Well, that implies that soon there'll be new methods of energy production. Well, there went the oil industry. There'll be new methods of ground and air transport. There goes cars and airplanes. There'll be new methods of computers and communication systems. There go those businesses. Economic chaos. Who's going to be the winner? Who are the losers? And the sixth reason is quite different. It's those seven cases that I've heard of pilots going up to chase UFOs and not coming back. Now, the government will go to great length to hide the causes of airplane losses. There's a book called By Any Means Necessary by William Burroughs, 2001. I can't remember the publisher, but you can find it on Amazon, I'm sure. B-U-R-R-O-W-S. And this is the story of 166 crewmen from American reconnaissance, military reconnaissance planes, which tickled was the word that they use, the radar systems in Korea, North Korea, Russia, and China, starting back in the 40s. You know, you approach the coast and see how quickly their radar comes on. You're loaded with electronics gear. And you try to map the frequencies and their response rate and repetition rate and all kinds of stuff. And sometimes our guys flew past the 12-mile limit, to say the least, and couldn't get away, and they were shot down. And we have the radio transmissions from them when that happened, and some of them supposedly were taken prisoner and tortured and so forth. Now, you know what? There wasn't one word in public in the United States or in the Soviet Union. We shot down some Russian ones, too, incidentally. Both sides had a common, each had his own reasons for not wanting to publicize it. We were violating their space, and we didn't want anybody, and the United States government didn't want to admit that. 166 people whose families were all lied to. Terrible accident, lost at sea, no bodies recovered, sorry about that. And it wasn't until 2001, more than 50 years after some of these events, that the families were gathered together and given the medals that their sons, brothers, fathers, whatever, had earned. So if they're not willing to talk about that, I mean, we're talking 166 guys.
I agree. You know, this brings us to a couple of questions that we have already. And for those of you who have just joined us, Stanton Friedman with us this evening. UFO researcher and writer extraordinaire, physicist, Mr. Friedman, Lindsay from Iowa would like to ask you a question, and I would,
sure.
And I encourage everybody to call in as well. We have our 877-489-6350, and toll free in the U.S. and Canada, it's 888-228-4494. Those numbers again are 877-489-6350, 888-228-4494. Now, Lindsay from Iowa has texted us and asked, what does Mr. Friedman think happened to the skilled pilots he was talking about just a bit ago?
To what?
I think that she was referring to the pilots that you were discussing their prowess in flying and suddenly come here and are shot down, disintegrated planes. What do you think? I think she's directly asking you what you think happened to those planes.
Well, I think we were, that the alien spacecraft took defensive action. Hey, leave us alone, I think. And when we didn't, they shot us down in self-defense. I remember one case over Cuba, and I talked to the National Security Agency guy at the listening post in Boca Chica, Florida, I guess it is, the nearest one to Cuba. And there's a whole sequence that they hear. They all had to be linguists, and the ground people were Russian-speaking, of course. The Cuban pilots were some were Russian, some were Spanish-speaking. Anyway, a UFO is seen by their radar coming from northeast to southwest. They scramble a couple of MiGs, and they spot it. This is broad daylight, and they report back. Spherical, no appendages, nothing sticking out. They instruct them by radio, some kind of, why would the aliens be listening to our radio? But anyway, they instruct them to, you know, get the heck out of our territory, and they ignore it. What should we do? They ask the ground. These decisions are made on the ground in Cuba. Shoot them down. Okay, so the lead, the two planes, a pilot and a wingman, the lead pilot announces that he's got a radar lock on. His missiles are armed, and we do it in the opposite order, but it doesn't matter here. And then suddenly the pilot of the second plane is shrieking because the first plane just disintegrated. So obviously they knew when there was a radar lock on, and you got to do something in a hurry, so you zap the guy who's giving you a hard time. And hopefully all the other guys and the guys on the ground will get the message. Leave us alone, you know. So and the other cases sounded very much like the same kind of thing. And I've heard, I'm still trying to get some more information. One pilot told somebody else, and I've talked to the pilot's wife. I'm waiting to get more data, that he was flying in Europe in the early 50s. And all he would say was, we lost 20 planes to UFOs. And
wow.
You know, so what I'm saying is, if you're going to bother them, they'll bother you back. And it's interesting, one of the stories I had was from a guy who was at a radar installation in Kalispell, Montana in the early 50s. And he said they got radio contact from Canada. Everybody expected the Russians to attack across the top, you understand. So what was going on, the dew line up there was important. Radio message down, saucer heading your way. So they pick it up on their radar, and they had a pilot in the neighborhood, an interceptor was up, so they vectored him in. They directed him toward the path of the incoming saucer. And they followed this, and then suddenly no more airplane, and the UFO left. Now, they knew exactly what direction he was flying, what altitude he was at. You know, there wasn't any uncertainty about that, you know, someplace out there. Oh, they knew what his track was. And the guy tells me, this was a quiet conversation, he says, we were instructed after that, take pictures, don't shoot. What can I say?
Very interesting.
So
very interesting.
They want to do their thing and leave us alone.
And what they're saying, I mean, basically I can imagine they probably are in the process of defending themselves. John from Omaha asks, how did Mr. Friedman make the jump from physics ufology?
Well, it wasn't really a jump. I mean, you're concerned with data, gathering facts, looking at information. I spent 14 years in industry I got started completely innocently. Certainly, if you'd have told me in the 1950s, I got my master's in 1956, went to work for General Electric on the Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Program, hadn't a thought in the world about flying saucers. In 1958, I was ordering books from a bookseller in New York, discount book place, and needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. I'm a cheapskate. What the heck? Discount books. There was one, the report on unidentified flying objects by Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt. He had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. Now, the Air Force was a co-sponsor of our aircraft nuclear propulsion program. That year, incidentally, we spent $100 million on the AMP program. Most people have never heard of it, but we employed 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. Anyway, so I ordered the book. It intrigued me. I figured the reason I ordered it, A, it was going to be free because shipping would have been a dollar. It was $2.95 marked down to a dollar. Hardcover book shows you how times have changed.
Sure.
Secondly, the Air Force was the co-sponsor on our program. Third, if these things were real, maybe they were using nuclear power, which would have helped our program, of course. And fourth, what the heck? It could be worth just a joke, be worth a laugh, but it wasn't costing me anything, so why not? Anyway, I read the book. It intrigued me. I shared it with a neighbor, an engineer 10 years older than I was. I was only 24 at the time. And he was more impressed than I was. Charlie was. Good engineer. Anyway, I moved to California, read 15 more books, some of which were utter trash, and I was still working as a nuclear physicist. And then I made an incredible discovery, for me anyway. At the University of California, Berkeley Library, I found a copy of Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14. Largest study ever done for the United States Air Force, not mentioned in any of the 15 books I had read. And I was astonished. Data on 3,201 sightings, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. But there was also the press release that was put out. It was distributed in October 1955. The report wasn't. This is before Freedom of Information, but Dr. Leon Davidson from Los Alamos got access to it and made copies available. Anyway, here's the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles, saying, quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available, unquote. Well, that seems very straightforward. There's really nothing to this. But when you look at the data, and I was looking, I'm a data guy, and look at all these charts and tables, and you copy down, hey, wait a minute. The unknowns weren't 3%. They were 21.5%. And they were completely separate from the 9.3% listed as insufficient information. So the Secretary of the Air Force flat out lied. These aren't little minor arithmetic errors, you understand. There's no way you can convert 3 to 21.5, you know. If it was 3.1, okay, I'll give you that one. But 21.5%. And it shocked me because I was accustomed working under security. Sometimes you tap dance around the truth. You can't always give out.
He tap danced a little. He did a little more than tap dance, I think.
Well, that's right. But to see blatant, flat-out lying, that shocked me. And that got me moving. That got me in, and I talked to my colleagues, shared data with them, you know, brown bag lunches at work. You know, between our nuclear stuff, we were talking about flying saucers. And speaking out was certainly not my intention at that time. That was the early 60s. But in the mid-60s, Frank Edwards in Indianapolis, he was a journalist and a big officer in NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And I had joined NICAP and APRO, the two major groups. And I got to know Frank when I worked for General Motors in Indianapolis. My history is 3 years on a program, then they cancel it. 3 years on another program, and they cancel it. 3 years on another program, and they cancel it. I set a record for working on canceled programs. Anyway, Frank sent me a copy of his new book. By this time, I was working for Westinghouse in Pittsburgh. And I called Frank, and I said, I was working on nuclear rockets. I said, Frank, I want to go public. What, you know everybody. Give me some names. So he gave me a number of names, including the producer for a radio show on KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the earliest big radio stations. And the show was called Contact, which I think was a very appropriate title.
I think you called that show.
Well, yeah, it was well known, and KDKA had it. It was a 50,000 watt clear channel station, so it had a huge listening audience. And I called this guy and mentioned Frank and stuff, and it was one of the, even though I was working for Westinghouse, which is gold plated credentials in Pittsburgh, because there are several Westinghouse divisions there, it was one of those, don't call us, we'll call you. Well, less than a month later, I get a call at 6:30 to be on a radio program at 7 o'clock. Somebody had canceled. And I never found out, but I suspect they had called several other people. I happened to live not far from the station, and it was one of these, could you please be on our show tonight at 7 o'clock? Well, yeah, sure, why not? So I went on the show, and I must admit I wasn't as good about handling hosts who say stupid things. I'm much better now. And somebody at work, a technician at work, a woman who worked at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab, as I did, contacted me. She'd heard the program, and it happened her book review club was reading Frank's book, Flying Saucer Serious Business. Would I give them a lecture? Well, sure. That was my first lecture in somebody's living room. They liked it. I did that Contact show a number more times, did a lot more of the what I call the chicken and peas circuit. Everybody wants free lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And then things changed a little bit. I'm driving to work one of 2 days in 3 years that I drove to work with a woman, Joanne, who was a PhD and a supervisor at Westinghouse. Not my boss, but I needed a ride because my car was in a garage. And I'm saying, gee, I wish I could talk at Carnegie Mellon University. And she says, Stan, well, why don't you talk to the dean? And I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. So I did, and he was delighted to book me a few weeks later. I had a morning talk, though. I thought, oh, gee, going to have to take some time off work. And he says, how much do you want? And I said, oh, how about $100? I figured he'd knock me down to 50. Sold, but then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series. $1,500, $1,600, $1,800, you know. Well, my talk went over very, very well, and he wrote a nice letter to the agent through whom he had booked the other speakers. And they booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit. Now, that's a bunch of hard-nosed engineers, you understand. This is in the late 60s. And I got paid $300 plus expenses, too, which came as quite a shock. You know? I didn't know speakers made money. I thought people got paid for being on the radio, you know, but it turned out most of the time you get paid what you're paying me, which is nothing. And so
But I'm all right as long as I don't say anything stupid.
Well, the response to the show was great in Detroit. They were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk. And there wasn't one nasty question. So I did a whole bunch more professional groups, and they responded extremely well. Sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, sections of the American Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. And my company was very cooperative, Westinghouse. I asked them, I said, look, I'd like to do more speaking, but I've got a job and a wife and a house and kids and a mortgage and a security clearance. I don't want to endanger any of that. I need some set of ground rules. What can I do? I mean, your job comes first, you know. And they came back to me. My boss went to his boss's boss. And they gave me three rules. One, you can say what you please on your time. Two, you can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But three, we'd like you to start with a disclaimer that the views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. Now, I think that's pretty darn nice.
I think so.
You know, what else could they do? Well, they did do something else. I get a call one day from, I was in radiation shielding for nuclear systems, and my counterpart at Los Alamos, they were also working on nuclear rockets as we were, called me and said, Stan, I hear you're giving a lot of lectures on flying saucers. I said, yep. He said, well, how about speaking to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society? I said, sure, be delighted to. He says, no, I mean on an expense account. I said, oh, I don't make those decisions. I mean, I'm in Pittsburgh, he's in New Mexico, you know. I said, I'll check with management and get back to you. And they said, yes. So I flew from Pittsburgh to Los Alamos on an expense account, everybody knowing full well I was going there to talk to the local section of the American Nuclear Society about flying saucers are real. And I went around, my counterpart introduced me to a lot of people and stuff, all out and above board, and we had 500 people at that meeting, which is a lot for them. And there weren't any negative questions again. And the reason for going through all this whole routine was to say, when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, as it did within a couple of years of that, I went full-time speaking because of the enthusiastic response of professional groups, Engineering Society in Baltimore and Cincinnati, half a dozen sections, management clubs of Lockheed and people like that. It wasn't the kook groups. These are very straight, solid, professional people. And I emphasize that because what I found is that while most people believe in UFOs, they believe that most other people don't, and their actions are determined by that misperception. When I check my audiences at the end of my lecture, never at the beginning, I find typically 10% will have had a sighting. How many of you reported it? 90% of the hands go down. Reason they didn't report when they tried to tell me afterward? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. So I want people to understand that it's okay. There have only been 10 or so PhD theses done about UFOs. There have been a number of courses taught, but most people have never heard about any of these. So I'm trying to encourage people, it's okay. You know, have your facts in hand. Look, in over 700 lectures, I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. You know, and you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics. Boy, I'm sure. You know, look right now at the political thing. There are plenty of hecklers out there.
Well, that brings us kind of, Stan, to our next caller's question, or our next writer's questions. Mike from California asks, has Mr. Friedman ever faced off against the amazing Randy? And if so, what was the outcome?
We were at the same conference of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, of which I was a member. And I asked him a couple questions, but we really didn't have a debate. I've written a paper about some of the silly things he's written about UFOs, giving specifics of what he said that was wrong. But remember, Randy isn't a scientist. He's a magician, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. He's an expert at deception. That's by definition what a magician is, isn't it? Get you to think something happened that didn't really happen. You know, so I've faced off against Seth Shostak, Michael Shermer, a couple of people, what was his name? There was a guy in England at the Oxford University Debating Society. I got 60% of the vote there, which I thought was doing pretty well. When I found, I did a tour of England, seven lectures, I guess. And I did 40-some interviews with these BBC guys with the wonderful radio voices, you know, and diction and stuff. They sound great. But they didn't know anything about the subject. Two of them, the first question they asked was, what does the T stand for, Stanton T. Friedman? That's real important, isn't it? They're not big on middle names over there. And it stands for Terry, for anybody who knows. When I was in school, everybody called me Terry. It's my middle name. So I keep the T in there just so people will know, yeah, it's me. You know, it's okay. So So
yeah,
I haven't faced off.
Well, you haven't faced off with them, and you're talking about the people in the United Kingdom, and which brings me to the interesting revelation that just came about in the UK, the release of documents surrounding UFO.
Yep.
Now, obviously, I think they are being time released, if I'm not mistaken, over a period of, I think it's 4 to 7 years or something
yep.
like
yep.
that. Some people say it's going to take a lot longer. Are they also being whited or blacked out in the same...
Well, no. No, because contrary to what people think, the news media has made it sound as these are all declassified hot stuff. They're not. There's no top secret material there. I've talked to people who looked at the stuff. And what they forget, I mean, the French did the same thing. The reason for doing this is because the Ministry of Defense in England was getting more Freedom of Information Act requests. Freedom of Information is new over there, just the last few years, not like here. And they were getting more requests, the Ministry of Defense, about UFOs than any other subject. And they were spending an awful lot of time. So now they're putting them at the National Archives. They got to go through and take out some personal information and stuff like that. But there's no real hot stuff there. That's why I mentioned General Bolander early. It's perfectly clear that in England and France, they're putting out their run-of-the-mill stuff that's been sitting in the files. And I should add, the United States has had available, if you go to the National Archives, there's 92 reels of microfilm on which there are 12,000 UFO sightings. And people act as if the U.S. has been keeping it back. Well, they've been keeping back the hot stuff, the reports which didn't make it in the Project Blue Book. But there's loads of good stuff in the Blue Book files. You wouldn't know it from the Air Force, but people who've, you know, gone to the files and checked through them have found lots of excellent cases. Some of the best are in Dr. James E. McDonald's testimony to Congress back in 1968. He gave 41 separate cases, outstanding paper. He had talked to over 500 witnesses, so he could be selective, pick the best cases. Radar visual sightings, sightings by pilots, by meteorologists, by astronomers, sightings over big cities, contradicting all the objections raised by the noisy negativists. You know, why don't pilots ever see them? Well, NARCAP, National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous phenomena. They've got well over 1,000 cases from pilots who don't want to talk, give their name out publicly because they might lose their jobs. But there's all kinds
but
of good stuff out there.
But they certainly do talk about it. You know, we've got a couple of quick questions. I'm hoping to get as many of them as I can in for our listeners. Sam in Utah asks, I've heard that the Mayans and Aztecs had amazing astronomical knowledge with calendars that predicted things like the precession in 2012. Do you think that that had some extraterrestrial tie-in?
That's a very interesting question because I heard an excellent paper by a couple from the University of Delaware, I think it was. They looked at about 10 old societies, Mayans, Aztecs, Incas. There's a lot of them out there. And they all have stories about aircraft coming down from space with spacemen, not gods. They checked with people who knew the languages very carefully. The historians would want to say, oh, they're just talking about myths about gods, you know. Well, myth is a term you use when you don't know what's going on, so accuse the other guy. But that's just a story. A good example of this is Heinrich Schliemann, a rich German archaeologist, amateur, figured out where Troy ought to be based on the Iliad of Homer. And the historians say, what do you mean, Troy? There is no Troy. That's a myth. It's a story. Well, he was rich. He could afford to pay people to dig down 75 feet where he figured it ought to be. It's back about 1875. And sure enough, they found Troy. So myths turn out to be reality. And yes, I think that these people have an oral history, if you will, of beings from the sky coming down. And, you know, we have an arrogance. We think we're the most, each generation thinks it's the most advanced generation there's ever been, and nobody before us was as smart as we are. Well, you know, when you start looking, you find out that we're not any smarter than the Greeks were 2,000 years ago. Oh, we picked up a lot of data along the way. But Greek literature isn't childish literature. It's very profound. And it's the same. The Chinese had all kinds of technology that the West didn't have. I was reading where a British general was surprised that in the Opium Wars that the Chinese were using paddle boats. Boy, they picked up on our technology real quick. Well, it turns out the Chinese had paddle boats 1,000 years earlier. So we like to think that these are all primitive societies, you know. They're not nearly as advanced as we are, but they were. And so I think that there have been past visitations. I think every library in the local galactic neighborhood lists Earth. You know, a nice place to visit. Wouldn't want to live there, though. It's a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. That's an accurate description, I hate to say.
Noah in Iowa asks a very interesting question, Stan. What does Mr. Friedman think about the idea that astronauts went to the moon, ran into extraterrestrials, and that's why we haven't been back to the moon?
Well, the question of why we didn't launch Apollo 18 and 19 is a very profound question. President Nixon, there was a recession on, said it's to save money. But the money was already spent. The rockets were all 18 and 19 were built. The astronauts were selected and trained. Yeah, so if you're paying the Navy guys, whether they're out looking for astronauts coming back or just doing their thing out on the ocean, that doesn't seem like a very good answer. So one possibility is that somebody said, stay the heck off our moon. I don't know, but I've talked to a number of astronauts, and they universally are greatly disappointed at how little progress we've made since, you know, we went to the moon, since Apollo 17 in 1971. They all thought we'd have a base there by now. We'd have been off to Mars. And there's a real question as to why not. Now, whether the aliens have met with somebody who said, hey, stay away. We don't want you up there. You guys are bad guys. I don't know what went on. That's a possibility. Incidentally, the astronauts are interested. The foreword to my book was written by Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon.
Now, I believe it was Dr. Mitchell that is involved in, is it the Noetic Society that he's involved
yes.
in?
Institute for Noetic Sciences, yes.
Yes, and I think that that's a very prestigious organization.
Yeah.
And there is a great deal of debate. I mean, they are really concerned with truth-finding there, as you are.
Yeah, oh, no question about it. Remember, Edgar had guts enough on the way back from the moon to run an experiment on telepathy. Now, that took courage. The word didn't come out for a while, but eventually it did. And he had a receiver down here, and he was sending messages, images, whatever you want to call it, from up there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Now, that took courage, I must say.
Well, we have one more question from John from the Canadian Rockies, and this one is going to tweak you, but I think it really does say something. Mr. Friedman, what in your opinion causes the stories of aliens conducting anal probes? Does it say more about us than it does about the aliens?
Well, yeah, most of the people who talk about anal probes do it in a very disdainful kind of fashion to sort of come up with a line that will make people laugh and not take the subject seriously. Yes, occasionally Earthlings have been probed. No question about that. I mean, Betty Hill, for example, they stuck a big needle in her navel. It's the other end of the system, if you will. But and whether they were doing amniocentesis or laparoscopy, we don't know. They're checking us out. They pick up specimens, examine them, toss them back most of the time, as far as I know, and without serious damage. That's much kinder. I mean, we do the same thing with polar bears up in northern Canada. You know, can you imagine a conversation? A young polar bear comes back to the headquarters. Hey, you're late, Joe. What happened? I said, well, you won't believe this. It's this crazy thing that came down from the sky. Guys, I guess they were guys, came out of it. They pointed something at me, and they put me to sleep, I think, because when I woke up, they were nearby. They put something around my neck, and they took off. What were they doing? Well, they were monitoring. They left something with them. And, you know, our guys, people generally aren't hurt by the abduction experiences. So, and if people are interested in a serious look at the abduction phenomenon, I strongly recommend the book Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by myself and Kathleen Martin, who is Betty Hill's niece and has all her tapes of the hypnosis sessions and so forth, and did an excellent comparative analysis of what Barney said and what Betty said and so forth.
There was a special on television about that, wasn't there?
Well, in 1975, James Earl Jones played Barney and Estelle Parsons played Betty, and it was well done. Would you believe Universal Studios went to the Air Force? They wanted a consultant. I was living in Southern California, and my name was given to them, so I was a consultant on that because of the Air Force.
Wow, that's
and
great.
I was the first to publish about the star map work that tells us where those guys are from or what neighborhood they're from, if you will. And I had met Betty and Barney way back in 68 and Betty many times since then. As a matter of fact, my movie available on DVD, of course, from my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, UFOs Are Real, has interviews with Betty Hill, Travis Walton.
It's a fascinating site for those of you that have not gone. Again, that's www.stantonfriedman.com. He has a lot of great information on that site. Thank you, Stan. This has been a pleasure having you on this evening. Very informative as always. I really wanted to have you on since our meeting in at the MUFON convention here a few years ago. And it is really a profound experience for those of you that have never attended any of those lectures or workshops at MUFON conventions. I highly recommend that you do. Credibility is everything, and when you meet the caliber of people that are involved in this this disclosure type events, I think it makes a great impact. I know it did for me. Stan, it's really
good.
Been wonderful having you. I hope to have you
my
on
pleasure.
Again soon.
Okay.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Tomorrow night, our host, David Swanson, will be interviewing the Vermont candidate for Attorney General. Join us 8 Eastern Time, and thank you all very much for being with us tonight. It's been great. I hope you have learned a little bit about what's happening in our UFO world. Good night, everybody.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief of death, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.